Mormon Matters Podcast is a production of the Open Stories Foundation and is seeking to build financial support separate from Mormon Stories Podcast. All donations to Mormon Matters are fully tax deductible and go directly towards keeping the podcast alive and towards building a community of support for Mormons like you. To support the podcast or to join the community, please become a monthly subscriber today at mormonmatters.org.
Merry Christmas. Happy New Year. This is Dan Witherspoon, and this is another edition of the Mormon Matters Podcast. We're grateful for you joining us, and I think we're going to have a show that will be super informative, possibly terrifically helpful for many of you in your own personal lives and the lives of families and friends. But if nothing else, I think we're going to access some deep spiritual principles, some things about the atonement of Christ or just spiritual power as it works in lives as we talk about the issues of addiction and recovery, and especially those spiritual and core religious aspects that get into play and seem to be fundamentally important and vital parts of an addict being able to, one step at a time, gain sobriety, keep their sobriety, stay in a path where they're being fed positive and good messages in addition to the ones that they've been listening to that sort of have said, I might as well give up. This is controlling me, and I'll just ride it out till I die. So just the optimism, the hope, all the different things that are in there are very, very spiritual. I've been informed by experiences with my own family, certainly a lower level addiction for me to tobacco many years ago, but it did have a spiritual component when I kicked that or was helped to kick that. And so I'm just surprised at how interested I am in this, even though I wouldn't say that I'm super immersed in it. So I think that you guys will enjoy this, and it's a neat time of year, as I know a lot of people are thinking about setting goals and all that stuff. We'll talk about goals and whether that's even a good way to go, but I know a lot of people are thinking about gaining some get better control in their lives, and so maybe this is a good time of year to be putting out this podcast. So I'm grateful to have three wonderful panelists, and as you all can probably understand, and it's certainly a major feature of 12-step type programs, is we're going to do our best to keep anonymity, and so all three of our guests will be using pseudonyms today, and we're going to try to eliminate geographical locations and things like that. Keith is our first panelist. Keith, I'd love to have you introduce yourself and share whatever you'd like about your journey and just what brought you to the point where we began to be in touch and to kind of plan this podcast.
Thanks a lot, Dan. As we've talked before, I've been a listener to the podcast for a while, and I'm grateful to have a chance to talk about something that I'm very passionate about. I began my journey in recovery many, many years ago, but it was a lot of starts and stops and a lot of relapses in between, and I have suffered from multiple kinds of addictions. The ones that were perhaps the most life-threatening were chemical addictions, for which I went through treatment and residential treatment and halfway house and so forth. And so I feel like my life was redeemed from a really, really bad place. My life now is much more comfortable in my skin and how I feel about myself. And I love doing service work. So I still participate in 12-step meetings, not nearly with the frequency that I once did. My real roots are in AA. Over a couple of years, I used to go to AA, Alcoholics Anonymous, almost daily for a few years. And in that program, I met some of the most inspirational people. In fact, in my old morning group, two or three of the people I became closest to were fellow members of the church. And so we shared that path together. But it's good to be here.
Great. Thank you for being here, and you've been the driving force in making this happen. The one identifier we are going to go ahead and give here is that our next guest, John, is Keith's son. So, John, would you tell us a little bit about however much you'd like to share at this point about your journey?
Sure. Growing up the son of an addict, there's a lot about addiction that I didn't understand, that I really wanted to understand. remember asking or wondering, Dad, why don't you just stop doing this and choose us over that? And in an effort to, I guess, rebuild the relationship and have a close relationship with each other, my dad would take me to Alcoholics Anonymous meetings as a child. And so I sort of became conversant in that culture as well as Mormon culture. I remember handling his little sobriety tokens with a lot of joy. And then it wasn't until later in my life that I found myself held captive by an addiction to pornography and masturbation. And that led me to the church's addiction and recovery program. It's not a meeting that I attend anymore, and maybe we can talk about some of the reasons why later, but those are what the few things that qualify me for being here.
Okay, well, thank you very much, and yeah, I'd love to dive in deeper on the effects on family and different things, whatever it takes to kind of really hear the full power of these things. And when you mentioned there, John, the church's program, I don't think I really did much in my opening framing. We are going to talk today about 12-step programs and simply addiction and recovery and sort of the insights and spirituality of that. And then we're going to talk about the church's program, who it's ventured into this in the last decade or so. And they're still in growing pains, and there's still different things going on. And so that will definitely be a piece of this podcast that I didn't really set us up for. But so thanks for that. Bill, you're our third guest, and we're grateful to have you. Thank you so much for coming on. Would you introduce yourself a little bit and however much of your story you'd like to share?
Sure. My name's Bill, and I'm a recovering addict, and I've been involved with 12-step recovery sober since 1991. Born in a part member family to the church, and grew up with a lot of choices and mixed messages and confusion about where happiness might lie, and I decided that the world was going to provide the things that I probably wanted, and choice by choice led me deeper and deeper into addiction, primarily drug addiction, but anything that changed how I felt was certainly okay with me. And I had been estranged from the church since I was a young man of teacher age, and had totally dismissed spirituality and the gospel as anything that would be important to me in my life ever. But after 20 years of hardcore drug use, of course, it didn't start out so hardcore, but it certainly ended up that way, and found myself in a detox, and I had tried to quit often enough times to know that even stopping was not enough, because then you had to live sober. But this was the first time I'd ever really been introduced to the program, and I was very surprised to find out that God was a key part of getting sober. And I was just miserable enough and teachable enough to listen to what they had to say, and I embraced that approach. I went into the bathroom and got on my knees and prayed. I felt hope start to come into my life, and my idea of turning my life over to God was to participate in the 12-step program, and that meant AA and NA and some of the other A's. And well, it's a long story, but it took me a year of sobriety before I could set foot in the church. But it didn't take me that long to feel the Spirit and learn the value of prayer and inspiration and the things that come through the Spirit. And so I come by my testimony through that roundabout way of the program of AA, and I don't question God's wisdom in using that path for me. And I did end up back in the church in full fellowship within a year, and temple worthy within another year, and Melchizedek priesthood holder, and on to all the blessings of living the gospel. And along with all the challenges of the recovering addicts, I've stayed involved in AA. I have become affiliated and serve in the addiction recovery program. Have high hopes for it being a blessing in the lives of addicts like me.
Very good, and we'll definitely be looking to your experience with that, especially as we get into that. But hey, thank you, you guys. That's wonderful to kind of get a starting point here. I'm sure more will emerge as we get talking. Just wanted to throw out for any of you who would want to speak up at this point. You're all taking a risk being on this show. You know, who knows who might recognize a voice, or you know, somehow or other. And anonymity is a big and a very important thing to you. So thank you for doing that. What's motivating any of you? What would your goals be for coming on the show that make this worthy risk? Keith, do you have any thoughts off the top?
Sure. Thanks for asking. It's my son put me up to it. That's the only reason. No, it is something that I'm really passionate about. And I've followed with great interest, for example, the Ensign magazine, the articles over the years that seem to be coming more and more frequently on the name withheld aspect. And I've appreciated that more and more people are willing to write about and have their weaknesses published in a way that can be edifying for people who might be going through the same thing. And I think that John's going to talk a little bit about storytelling and the power that it has. But I have also sensed from a little bit of my own personal participation and from a lot of conversations with some of my brothers that are very involved in the church program that the principles of AA at first are very difficult for some reason for the traditional LDS member or church leader to wrap their arms around. My hope, I don't know, Dan, how many of your bishops and stake presidents are tuned into Mormon Matters, but certainly a lot of your listeners are involved in different things in the church, and this might be a tool for either them personally or some of their family members or ward members or just their loved ones. So that's why I'm here.
Good. Well, thank you very much. John or Bill, either of you have any like goals you'd love to state outside or reasons for being here?
Well, you know, I guess the simplest thing to say is, you know, this is in the spirit of practicing step 12, you know, to carry the message to the addict who still suffers. And so that's got to always be important to somebody that's received that blessing in their life. And as we're under obligation or that gift's been given, to try to pass it on. And so that's really the primary purpose. But I also feel, I've always felt this way, that Latter-day Saints have a special challenge in recovery. And they don't fare too well all the time in AA. And the guy that, the Latter-day Saint that tries to avoid AA and recover just in the church program, he doesn't fare too well either. And so my desire, be somewhat of an ambassador, to build a bridge between those two worlds, as we know that all truth is circumscribed into one great whole. There is no two camps of truth. But we do experience that. Those of us in the recovery program experience a lot of enmity and prejudice and fair share of ignorance, and that would be my desire, to make a place where the Latter-day Saint can be a Latter-day Saint and be an addict and be filled with hope for his or her recovery. That would be my wish.
Fantastic. Thank you. John, anything to add or anything to particularly echo?
Well, yeah, I like what Bill said about the 12th step. That's really what I guess this motivation is for me, is to bring the message of the 12-step program to other people who might be suffering in the same way. And also, like Bill, I will admit there's a lot that I don't understand, and I'm not going to claim any knowledge of, you know, what the brethren ought or ought not to be doing. But in regards to the addiction and recovery program as it's practiced now, I've just had some experiences that were difficult for me that I think can be overcome. Just air it out and see if there are ways that we might not be able to suggest improvements to the church's program. Because like Bill and Keith, I am inexorably a Mormon, and my recovery is, I can't separate those two worlds. I mean, it's the 12 steps demands your complete spiritual attention, if that makes sense. And the Mormon religion is very similar that way. So I want to be able to incorporate these two worlds, and I hope this program can help do that.
Wonderful. Thank you, guys. I want to dive into just the nature of addiction, the extent of addiction, what has been the history of attempts at recovery. You know, all of a sudden in the 30s, Bill Wilson and the group created Alcoholics Anonymous. The big book emerged sort of saying, here we are a bunch of guys who've had success in at least entering into sobriety and maintaining our sobriety, and here are the key ways that we did this, and we don't think there's any shortcuts. And so all that emerged, but I'd love to kind of, you know, let's kind of set the wider background, and then what is it that they hit on that can kind of help us frame this in a sort of a spiritual way. So, Keith, are you able to talk with that? What's the background and the bleak news that was sort of prior to AA coming along and at least seeming to really strike a chord?
I'll take a shot at it, but I imagine Bill's more conversant. I will just say that if anyone wants to read the real blueprint for recovery, it's the so-called Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous. It's funny, it's printed just like the old blue Book of Mormons, usually with a blue cover. But it's you can find it on Amazon or anywhere. Practically, there are a lot of recovery-type bookstores. I find it at Barnes & Noble. There's a whole area in the bookstore. It's kind of funny. Someone pointed out these books that require our dependence on God can be found in the self-help section of the bookstore. So that's a good LDS approach. It's in the self-help section. So anyway, you can read there, and there are true historians, people as passionate about Alcoholics Anonymous as historians in the church, and they can go on for hours and days. I would just say there was a group called the Oxford Group, which were trying to practice certain spiritual principles, and through a series, in my opinion, of great miracles, Bill Wilson, the original alcoholic number one, I was exposed to the Oxford Group and found something useful, exciting, and he was trying to incorporate these principles in his life when he found himself once with some recovery, some sobriety from alcohol on the road, and met some real devastating reversals in a business plan, and suddenly his options, that tunnel vision that almost every alcoholic knows the feeling, his options started to come down to drink, and he desperately needed to do something. And so he made contact with the people in Ohio where he was working and was able to get in contact with alcoholic number two, Dr. Bob. And he went to his hospital room and began to share with him the principles. And most addicts and alcoholics can't stand to be preached at. They cannot stand to be told what they need to do, rebellious by nature and having been defeated a million times. But his purpose in visiting with Dr. Bob was only, primarily, I should say, to keep himself from drinking. And he passed no judgment. And suddenly a spark was kindled. And you know, I can wax poetic, but it began a movement to change the world, in my opinion. And they discovered that the most effective way to develop recovery or sobriety is through working certain steps or principles and by working with other alcoholics. And as soon as we stop remembering that our fellows that still suffer, we're potentially on the road to relapse. So that's a very sketchy, short history of where this program came from.
Bill, do you have a shot or anything to add?
Well, I think that was pretty good overview of how the program got started. I do think that one of the things that sets AA apart from the traditional therapeutic approach or the traditional religious approach was that there was a blending of understanding that addiction was a disease process. They didn't know near what they do now about the disease of addiction, but they could clearly see how it manifested. And Dr. Silkworth was one of the pioneers in really coming to see this disease process and the driving force it was in the lives of addicts and alcoholics. And so couple that knowledge with the hand of God and bringing a spiritual solution to this very medical, physical problem, I think is the interesting and what makes it different. It really is a merging of those two worlds. And we are dealing with something that's, I always say to the guys, well, it's you cannot repent for being sick. And there's surely some repenting to be done, but there's an awful lot of healing and restoration that needs to come to pass. And that is hard to control or manage. You know, you've got to just receive it under the terms given. And they're not too hard. God doesn't ask too much.
Cool. And we'll continue to definitely dive deeper. John, anything you want to add as far as prior to, you know, what was going on in the world before AA came along and sort of added this spiritual piece or?
No. That's a short answer.
Well, here's, I first really was just like, wow, this is powerful stuff. Probably 4 years ago, I'm an avid listener of Krista Tippett podcasts, Speaking of Faith, you know, up until recently, now it's called On Being. And she did a show on, called The Spirituality of Addiction and Recovery or something along those lines, and I'm happy to post it here. But she talked basically about, you know, prior to this, if you were an addict or an alcoholic or something, it's basically, the world was very bleak for you. It generally led to death. There just wasn't any real hope for recovery because no one quite understood this. And yet, and they would try through typical physical or typical psychotherapy and whatnot that to do this. And Carl Jung was an early correspondent of Bill Wilson's who would say that, you know, I loathed to treat addicts because I didn't have any tools, but I did begin to notice that those that had a spiritual sort of experience or have some sort of experience of the spirit in their lives were the ones that did better. But I admire, I don't know, there's apparently this famous letter where he uses the phrase, you need spiritus contra spiritus. You need spirit to conquer spirits, you know, meaning a little play on the word for drinks, you know, and it was this idea. So he was very encouraging that says, you guys are coming onto something new in an area that we are failing in otherwise. And so Bill Wilson and apparently, from at least this podcast, there's the biographer of Bill Wilson, a book called My Name is Bill. I believe her last name is Cheever. She wrote that book, and she talked about him apparently having, you know, these stops and starts where he would notice that he could go longer without a drink if he talked to another person who was trying to stay sober. That helped him a little bit. But then, you know, that would only last so long. And then he would do something else. And he was kind of learning along the way through trial and error these different things that would happen and then finally merged into this. But he apparently also had a very big, clear religious experience. Do either of you, any of you know more about that? I haven't read his biography about a room filled with light and him truly feeling like God touched him and called him. And from that point on, he was able to maintain his sobriety.
If you read his own story in the big book, I don't quite equate it with the visitation of God the Father and the Son, but I do, just in the impact that it's had on the world, I do believe he was delivered in a flash because he was supposed to go forward with this. And to me, it was a huge spiritual manifestation. It was, that, you know, to me, it's a very, very sacred thing.
You know, in the big book, it doesn't talk about the white light, but of course, if we've read any of the history, we know that he did experience that great white light, and we can't quite imagine what it was. It's interesting to me as a Latter-day Saint that there was no personage connected with that light, but that it was light, and that it was profoundly life-changing for Bill. If you look at Bill's story, he started out very gifted, competent, probably charismatic and intelligent person, but he set his sights on worldly things, and he just so happened to have a sensitivity to alcohol. And that was one of his weapons of war. He said, out of this alloy of drink and speculation, I forged a weapon that would one day turn in its flight like a boomerang and all but cut me to ribbons. And I just find that interesting. I really relate to that, thinking that that drugs and alcohol were going to somehow make me better, smarter, more confident. And Bill really believed that, and I really believed that. But as he proved to be an addict or an alcoholic, he, of course, the drinking got more and more, the benefits got less and less, his ability to function diminished, and in the end, he was all but destroyed. And that's the place where he could, when his friend came and told him that he had had a delivery from alcoholism through God and religion, he, Bill, out of lack of any other hope, listened. And his story is very interesting as he starts to recall personal spiritual experiences throughout his life, just little ones. And the brethren have told us that everyone has had spiritual experiences, but often don't recognize them as such. And Bill, we see Bill recall those. And so with enough misery and enough open-mindedness about a spiritual solution, Bill goes into the detox and puts these principles into practice, starting off with turning his life over to God in a prayer and going on to look at what he needed to change following the pattern he was given by his friend. And he said that he had that great experience. He said it was electric. And we know through reading his biography that he, you know, was a great white light. And, then, you know, I'm very inspired by Bill. I believe he was foreordained. That's just my opinion, to start Alcoholics Anonymous. I don't think that that was just some little side note that he got lucky on, because there's just been too much good fruit, including that we're, as members of the church, talking about how can we better utilize what God gave Bill.
Terrific.
I just think it's very inspirational.
Yeah, from the little I know, I'm really impressed too. One of the things that I thought was interesting, there was a phrase, I think it was in the Krista Tippett podcast or else something I read, but the emphasis is on the importance of faith. You know, of course, you don't have to say God, you don't have to say Jesus Christ in alcoholism, but that you have faith, but no one prescribes the content of your faith, right? It's that you have faith in higher power, something beyond yourself that will aid in your ability to achieve sobriety and things like that. But yet, no one is going to claim that it has to be a two-person just within a white light and things like that, right?
Yes. But it's interesting to me as a Latter-day Saint to look at Bill's experience in the context of our understanding of God and the gospel plan. And we know that there is only one access to the Father. We know there is only one way to access the grace of God. And I think it's really wonderful that he doesn't demand that we all know that to start to partake of that. I also think that we have to see that I think a lot of naive and people who haven't been around AA, immediately their hair on the back of their neck goes up and their mind slams shut, and that just can't be. But the fact is, all AA says is you're going to be taught by the Spirit who God is. We're not going to try to teach you. They're not trying to say, pick a tree as a higher power. They're saying God as you understand him. And I think we all understand that the Spirit or light of Christ, at least, will be the factor. And God will reveal to that individual himself as he sees fit. And that's not my call or your call or anybody's call.
Cool. Thank you. So for whoever wants to dive in, I don't want to constantly throw to Keith first or whatever, so but feel free among yourselves to just dive in here. Who would like to present just an overview of what the 12 steps are, what they aren't? We can read the language of them and things like that, but I'd love a little bit more, you know, than just the couple of sentences that each one is, and just to sort of give a feel of the character of this spiritual alchemy that has been proven to unfold in thousands and millions of lives through these steps. So we're going to ignore the church and its attempts to strengthen these and to make certain things more particular for Latter-day Saints. But I'd love to hear the AA core stuff. I want us to talk about what a typical AA meeting is and why you guys have found, you know, or at least the typical 12-step based on the big book kind of meeting is, and why you guys have found strength in those things too. So let's just make that our next 20, 30 minutes if we can.
I'm really, really enjoying your comments very, very much, Bill. So I'll just make a little intro and yield most of the time to you. But to me, the most profound of the 12 steps is the very first one. And it's a rather counterintuitive step that says that a person, in order to recover, has to come to a position in their heart that they recognize that they've lost power, they've lost control, that they're that without some intervention, they will continue to drink, or they will continue to use drugs, or they'll continue to view pornography, or they'll continue to overeat, or a number of other addictions. And without some intervention, this will be their situation for the rest of their life. And usually, type of use or abuse becomes worse and worse over time. So the first step, which coming from my own family background, I'm pretty sure I speak for a lot of LDS people, my family background was that if you get up earlier and you work harder and you just out hustle the next guy, you're going to do just fine. And so the idea of being powerless is actually counterintuitive for me. But alcohol and drugs and other addictions brought me to that point. So that's actually a principle that's very clearly taught in the scriptures, but it's not very clearly evoked in our normal like Sunday school teaching and things like that. The second thing that I think many LDS people think that they can skip is the second step, which says that they came to believe that a power greater than themselves could restore them to sanity. And a lot of people will say, well, I'll just check that one off because I already know that Jesus Christ has the power. I was baptized. I could give you the articles of faith when I was little. So we can skip that one. Mm-hmm. But really, the way that we access that power, I think Bill was beginning to talk about that, is a very, very important component. And obviously, to me, it's obvious that a member of the church who is struggling with addiction has developed some faulty beliefs about who God is, and especially who God is in relationship to them. And then the third step, I won't go through each and every one of them.
Right, but the first three do go together.
Yeah. That after you've come to this awareness of your powerlessness and how your life's unmanageable, and that there is this power, at least you can see the effect of this power in other people, other addicts or alcoholics. The third one is that you've come to a point where you're going to make a decision, a conscious decision to turn your life and your will over to the care of God. And for me personally, I do that all the time, and then I take it back. I turn my will over to God, but very quickly I decide, no, that's not what I meant. I'll let you control this part of my life, but not that, you know. And so this surrendering control, I don't know, Dan, if you can relate, I think you can. It is sort of counterintuitive that you're going to give power to God. It seems so logical, but it's very, very hard to practice for me, at least, and I think for a lot of other people. Four to nine. The next six steps are primarily about going through your past and understanding places where you've caused harm, where you've created fear and resentment and harm, and making an inventory of these things, which is a very...
I love the word fearless inventory.
Yeah.
I love that. Yeah, I'm great at making lists, but you don't really get to the deep, dark, ugly parts of the closets, you know, that
right.
need some corners and cleaned out and things, yeah.
Certainly, my core belief was that if you really knew me, you would hate me, you'd reject me, and so it was really important for me to protect certain secrets and certain behaviors and stuff so that I could get along. But then you, after you've created this inventory and you've prepared yourself, then you present the inventory to another person, typically your sponsor, and this is... also, this disclosure, I think, is a very extremely freeing practice, but it's also can be, very fear-inducing as well. You took a look in 6 to 7, you take a look at your life in general and see what are the character defects. And I think it's interesting that they don't use the word sin, because AA tries very hard to avoid words with lots of moral overtones. But your character defects, what are they? How have they manifested themselves in your life? And 7 is very simply, but very repeatedly, coming to God in prayer and asking Him to help to remove those defects of character. And then step 8 is through this process, you've certainly made a list of people that you've harmed, that you've hurt in one way or another. And so you write down this list thoroughly. And again, can be kind of a terrifying step when you really put the names on paper. And then step 9, you go about making amends to them. And I'm sure if you want to take the time, I don't know how long you want to go on this, but I'm sure Bill could speak to how that process can be very hard, but extremely freeing. And, you know, I can say that if you want to use the word testimony, my witness of the power of the 12 steps started many, many, many years ago when a person approached me who was a classmate in college, and in the process of making her ninth step amends, she told me about having stolen a calculator from me 15 years before, and she was contacting me after this long time to make amends so that, and obviously I said, I don't care about the calculator. I hope you're well. But she says, I'm not doing this for you. I'm doing this for me because I don't want to drink again. And it was extremely profoundly moving to me that she had the courage to contact me, who, you know, I feel like we respected each other. And in my own recovery, I could tell you, don't have time now, but I had what I consider a true miracle for myself when I was trying to do my first major ninth step, where God orchestrated things so I could make some amends that needed to be made. So, and then 10, 11, and 12, sometimes I refer to the maintenance steps there. When you're wrong, promptly admitting it, which is a daily process, and trying not to build up a lot more crap in the closet that you can keep yourself clean on a daily basis. And I know your recent podcast on prayer, improving your conscious contact with God. That's a phrase that's in the 12 steps, where it's a matter of prayer and meditation. And then finally, I think Bill already referred to the 12th step is, once you've had this spiritual awakening, you're going to carry this message to other people. And it only survives because people are willing to share, you know. So that's a summary.
Powerful, just even that much. Bill, he keeps asking you to add things. Can we go ahead and see if you're willing to do that? How would you revisit, especially like those first three, and really hit us harder with those, or whatever, however you just take it however you'd like.
Well, that was a pretty good overview of the program. I think it's important to kind of keep it simple and break it down a little bit. And one of the phrases that people use, kind of the Reader's Digest version of the steps, and they'll say, trust God, clean house, and work with others. And so that kind of helps you a little bit get an idea of what it's all about. Another way of breaking the steps down is, step one is the problem, step two is the solution, and step 3 through 12 is a program of action. And so it's important to kind of recognize that, you know, we have to understand the problem, and most of us had to hit our bottom and, like the prodigal son, have exhausted every way we could do it our way before we were even open to anything other than our way. And the way proves to be a power greater than human power. And I think being restored to sanity is an important thing to talk about. That was really part of what struck me in early recovery, was that no matter how bad I wanted to do good, and no matter how bad I wanted to stay sober, I had the mind of an alcoholic addict that was going to come up with a good idea to do it again. I was going to throw out all the facts and all the consequences of the past, and some weak little idea to go ahead and try it one more time was going to prevail. That was a proven fact about addiction. And so step two promises protection from that element of addiction. And that is our only protection from that insanity of the first drink, they call it. And when we come to believe in that, it follows that, well, how does he plan on doing that?
Right.
And we use words carefully in AA, but really, when we decide to embrace this program, one of the key principles becomes obedience. Now, you don't tell an alcoholic you're going to have to be obedient, because you'll see nothing but dust as he runs. But Bill had a real knack for sliding things in, and I think of the Big Book as a parable for alcoholics, and they're able to receive what they're able to, and sufficient to help them tap into the power of God. But
the obedience isn't to a person or to your sponsor. Maybe it's to your sponsor a little bit, but it's obedience to the higher power.
It's to the principle. And it says, In the big book, rarely have we seen a person fail who has thoroughly followed our path. And the path is the 12 steps. And yes, you will need to have a sponsor, and you will need to be willing to take suggestions. It's totally a program of choice. But the fact is, if you dilute it down with too many, I don't want to do this, I don't want to do that, you've really painted yourself into a corner again, and that flies in the face of step one that says, I'm powerless over my addiction, and I cannot manage my own life. And because addiction and the will are so intertwined that we've defiled our ability to act correctly, because that insanity is taking you the long way around the barn to that next drink. And so the humility and the willingness, the submissiveness, those are important things, but we need somebody that's been there to help us. And that person speaks through the power of testimony. He's not theorizing. He's not telling us what we should do. He simply tells us what he did. And if we want what he has, we should be willing to follow. And it's hard, but if you've hit a low enough bottom, you're usually willing to do that.
Yeah, do you mind? I want you to say all the more that you want to about, but let's talk about that rock bottom issue, and let's talk about releasing any of that pretense that I can control this anymore. Do you have to be at rock bottom to even accept step one? It seems to me that maybe, you know, a lot of people could check out AA and not realizing they're at rock bottom, or they may, you know, they're just not quite ready to go. Where does rock bottom, and however that manifests for somebody, really work? Does it truly have to be right at the beginning?
Well, I think a lot of people come to the program with impure motives, maybe to please a probation officer or to please a spouse or just to make things maybe look good. I think a lot of us did that. For myself, when I was taught about the disease and the way it works in our minds and bodies, that got my attention. See, I went in there thinking I was really hip, slick, and cool, and I'm going to make everybody think I'm cleaning up, and then I'll be able to get my way better.
I see, yeah.
But then I did learn that this was a disease and that it couldn't be beaten by human power, and that most addicts did die a miserable death. Jails and institutions are death, they say, and I find that to be true. But the theory is that as higher bottom people associate with lower bottom recovering people and see the parallels and similarities, and if they can see they're on that fast track to that very same story this guy's telling about, that they're able to identify with that and say, that's me and I don't want to go there. I personally feel that that's got to be a gift from the Spirit, because most addicts are very stubborn and think they're going to be an exception to this destruction. I know I did.
Doesn't it say in the big book, as the guys that are, you know, the plural that is speaking in this book, many of us thought that we could skip a step or take an easier way or something, but we have found that we can't. Every bit of this has to be lived, otherwise you just won't make it.
Yeah, there's a lot of warnings, and they're based on what many of us tried to do, take shortcuts, and the consequences came pretty swiftly.
Mm-hmm. Either of you guys, John, we haven't heard from you in a while. Anything about rock bottom, or just your own thinking about those? Let's say we're kind of in the first three-step area right now.
Yeah, when I first read through the big book, as it's been commented before, you know, at the second step. Well, I'm Mormon, and I have this strong belief in God and Jesus Christ. And I remember there was a chapter in the big book called We Agnostics, and I thought that that would be something that I could skip, you know. But as I read it, I realized this agnosticism that the big book is described my situation exactly. Agnosticism isn't there may or may not be a God, but rather it's an approach to life which says, I'm God, you know, that I am, if life is a stage, I want to be the director of this play, mm-hmm, you know, mm-hmm. And denying God his supremacy in my life, and, you know, this proclivity that I have to control the consequences of my actions and manage affairs in just the way that I think seems appropriate. I think that is a hallmark of addiction, and giving that up, you know, in the first three steps, I think is part of what makes Alcoholics Anonymous such an amazing spiritual program.
Cool. Keith, anything to add in at this point?
When it comes to the so-called bottom, the rock bottom that people hit, there's a phrase frequently used in the program called we learn to identify and not compare. And I laugh when people first show up at a 12-step meeting for their very first time. Very few of them are just casually interested in what happened to you guys. And boy, if I ever got that bad, I'd get help too. You know, I'm nowhere close to as serious as you. And they may actually say that to themselves internally. But even, you know, I know we're going to transition over to leaders of the church and their role. But even certain leaders of the church that I've dealt with have that great innate capacity to relate and to identify and rather than to compare. And so they may begin to speak of their own brokenness and their own, and it may be something that we would laugh at, like their inability to not eat a Snickers bar. And that may be the best thing that they can come up with. But truly, people in the program try their hardest to listen to other people's stories and pick out things that sound familiar and then let the other things go if they're going to be successful in making the meetings useful.
That's actually a great spiritual discipline for all of us. Everything doesn't have to relate, and you don't have to dismiss this person just because a piece doesn't feel, you know, so there with us. You know, if you guys don't mind for a second, I know that at least Keith and John are aware of, you know, sort of the history of my contributing to these Mormon discussions, and I'm a big James Fowler Stages of Faith guy. I found a lot of strength from that as I was, you know, wrestling with a sort of a stage four spirituality. Just to let you guys know, I'm thinking now about the third step of, you know, of surrender, you know, make a decision to turn our will over to the lives and care of God as we understand God. That's actually what stage six, the very highest state of being, is within Fowler. But, of course, I don't think that somebody in the early stages of AA quite has it. But it really is the final goal, the idea that you step out of the way. Your will steps out of the way. It's freely given over to where then God or the universal will simply goes through you. Jesus, I am the way. I am the truth. I am the life. You know, you're looking for the Father. You look, see me. You've seen the Father here because I'm a perfect mirror. And you get that in Buddhism and Zen and different things, to where the whole idea is to let the divine will, you know, be your will is in such alignment with the divine will that they're one and the same. And so I don't know if I've screwed it up. There might be something in stage three that I'm sort of comparing to this, but I kind of wanted to just throw it out there as sort of this is profound stuff. You know, I look at Messiah 3:19, and I see us in Mormonism totally botching it when we get into this whole become as a little child, and unless you do that, you will no longer do it. The child that you're becoming again is not the child who hasn't gone through the trial. You know, there's a power structure between a parent and a child where a child submits to the parent simply out of a lack of power. But what God's calling us to in the last time, you know, become submissive, meek, humble, patient, full of love, willing to submit to all things which the Lord seeth fit to put upon him, even as a child submits unto the Father. This is an adult who has said, thy will be done, not a child who says, I can't go against the power of the Father. Of course, I'm going to submit. You know what I mean? Does any of that help at all with the three stages of you got to just get over yourself because you've lost that ability to really run the show, and you've got to take those steps to admit it?
I would just say that I'm when people who are unfamiliar with the 12-step program attend a meeting, maybe it's a bishop or just, you know, just whoever, they'll frequently say they felt the Spirit of God stronger in that meeting than in any meeting they'd ever participated in, or at least is in rare company with other meetings. And I think maybe, Dan, you just hit on something, that when people do become submissive and they are no longer trying to prove their point, but they're willing to listen, that the Spirit is really, really manifest powerfully. And I'm sure that Bill could tell a lot of stories about strangers to the program coming in who have great familiarity with spiritual principles and commenting afterwards that they were more moved at this meeting than anything. So maybe we are closer to that sixth step than we think. You know, it is about surrendering.
Yeah, I think it's important to understand that, you know, especially as Latter-day Saints and with an eternal perspective, you know, the sky is literally the limit. But as an alcoholic or addict dragging himself into the program, a step three decision would simply be to remain abstinent, trust in God, being God, running the show of life, and above all, following through in steps 4 through 12. And then as we do that, more is revealed. See, we always want to know the mysteries, but God, we know, well, he wants us to read our scriptures and pray every day and have family home evening and go to church. And yes. Well, what about something more? You know, well, I'll tell you more as soon as you get the basics down. And that's how the program works. It works in the very same way, line upon line, precept upon precept. And this 12 steps is so basic and so fundamental and so simple that we do look beyond the mark. But Bill says simply that the price for this great relationship with God and sobriety, the price that has to be paid is the destruction of self-centeredness. In other words, I can't be a law unto myself anymore. I can't live in that enemy to God mindset that's so common to man. I got my chance at it and it failed, and I really am like a child now, like it or not. Now, if I don't want to accept that, I can go on to the bitter end and hope I can keep a drink in my hand till I'm dead. And that's where I existed 20 years ago, just not knowing how I could go on, but not knowing what to do about it. And that's a choice. But I think we have to keep it simple. I think that's one of the things Latter-day Saints go, oh, turn my will over to God. That means I'm going to have to go to church every Sunday. I'm going to have to pay my tithing. Well, maybe, yeah, but first let's get sober, go to meetings, get a sponsor, and do a four-step. And believe that God's running this show. That was quite a thing for me to practice believing in an omnipotent God that was in control. Because my mind said, wait, there's too many poor people, there's too many sad people, and I'm on the top of that list. Is there really a God? I didn't understand. And so you really got to start at a very simple level because we've ruined our thinking.
Very good. I like it. Yes. Thank you. Awesome. What else in the steps have you guys found to be the most profound, you know, where are the core spiritual insights that jump out to you, or at least if you've practiced the steps, what's opened your heart the most?
Yeah, you know, Dan, we might be moving into this, but one of the unique attributes of Mormons as they approach the 12 steps can also be a liability, and I think Bill expressed it perfectly. And I don't know if this is the right segue to go, but, you know, you lay out a list of 12 steps and you present them as steps, and a Mormon addict will look at those steps and say, well, my goodness, you know, this is something I can do. I'll look at them as goals, you know, and I'm going to...
Right.
And I'm going to immerse myself in these steps and do it perfectly, and that... paradoxically can be another form of self-will, you know, of trying to run the show. And it's, you know, it's a strange paradox. It's obedience, but without willing, you know, a sort of relinquishing of the will and a letting go. It's grace. It's this worldview that I'm not in charge. And so that I think can be something, I don't know, difficult for a Mormon like me to wrap my head around. I just, you know, I have this problem and I can't stand for it. My wife can't stand for it. I need to get over it. And so give me the steps and I'm going to run through them, you know, and that might not be the right, that I might be at a disadvantage there.
Well, they say in the program that an addict or alcoholic who sponsors himself has got a fool for a sponsor. And the idea that there is a submission and a humbling that we, you know, submit ourselves to of our own free will and choice. And like a child learning about God through their experience with their parents, I think an addict can learn to get out of the way by allowing a sponsor who genuinely cares for him and also cares for his own sobriety and has some experience there and credibility to submit to his suggestions. He naturally begins to be taught by the Spirit how to partake of the Spirit. And it's really it's profoundly powerful, but yet don't try to analyze it too much because it's a bit of a mystery. But that getting out of the way, I think that's where a sponsor really comes in the beginning. Because if you're too self-directed, you're still running the show, even if it's got a veneer of recovery or gospel on it.
Yeah, neat. I shared a little bit in the prayer podcast that John referenced here about my own prayer relationship with God when it's at its best. It gets to the point of, you know, my soul's bare sitting there, and God and I are looking at each other and saying, yep, that's it. That's the situation. Let's get to work. And I have had a couple of relationships with good friends who have gotten to that point where I have that person clearly know who I am, and they'll give me hard feedback. But I recognize that it's a feedback of love. And I'm guessing that that's what you guys have learned when you've worked with a sponsor that's been a good relationship. Is that sort of it?
Yeah, I think that's a pretty good comparison. One thing that I think the 12 steps are different is that we do follow that pattern and try not to take too much license with it. We share our experience, and that's, I think, valid, but we've got to be as true as we can to that pattern and path and those principles to get the desired results. And so that's the kind of marvel about it is you just follow the path and you get those blessings, and you do want to kind of enhance it or fix it or, you know, add to it. You don't need to.
Cool. Keith or John, anything with sponsors or the relationship of, you know, feedback and just sort of let's really assess?
I think I mentioned that in the mid-90s, I went through a treatment program, a 30-day residential program, and I had everybody recognize the counselor I had was the most hardcore kick-your-butt counselor that they assigned to me. And I, you know, I'm sad to say that within, I think, 3 days of graduation from this institution, I was in full relapse, and I came back very, very defeated. I really left with the highest hopes. I think I figured it out. I'm going to do this. Kind of what John was describing a minute ago. And he handed me an article. He says, I've been thinking a lot about you, and you can access it on the internet. It's called Surrender Versus Compliance in Treatment. And it really irritated me because it said that he said, you've been complying all the way through treatment. Everything I ask you to do, you're eager to do it and do it well and do it quickly so you can get that one checked off, but you have not broken your heart. Kind of what we talk about with a broken heart and a contrite spirit. And you feel like you should be the mayor of this little town because you've done so well. And someday you'll be invited back as a speaker. Maybe you'll be on Mormon Matters someday.
So, that's a pinnacle, man. That's a high point.
See, I'm still struggling with that ego, aren't I? But he said, and it really irritated me because I would say, you don't understand. I am trying to surrender. I am trying. And he goes, that's it. You're trying. Surrender is not trying. Surrender is surrendering. And I go, I don't understand that. How can you not try to do something? Because to me, it was all about effort, effort, effort. And, you know, the saying about, you know, easy does it and let go and let God, all these little phrases that are used in the 12-step programs really are seriously profound. And it was a new way of thinking for me to, you know, when I really did hit my bottom, which was soon to come after that, I recognized something inside of me that in my mind, I still visualize myself at that extremely distressing moment in my mind, waving the white flag and saying, okay, I am going to die. I need your help. If I continue to do what I'm doing, I'm dead and I don't want to die. And it was seriously one of the most peaceful moments in the state of massive chaos that I've ever experienced because I finally surrendered, you know?
Hmm. Very cool. John, anything?
No, nothing.
I mean, about the sponsor. Okay.
Oh, about the sponsor. Yeah.
Well, just the relationship of getting feedback from somebody who cares, but also kicking your butt, you know, or whatever it would be.
Yeah. And, I'm really excited to hear Bill go on about this. I don't know when we're going to transition into the ARP program, but when the church incorporates the 12 steps, they look at the institution of sponsorship, and the assumption is, well, we have that built into the church. It's your bishop, you know? And I think that there are reasons to maybe take a second and reconsider that assumption, that maybe a sponsor isn't the same thing as the bishop, that maybe you ought to go for someone else. And I really want to hear Bill talk about this for a minute.
Good. Well, and let's not talk about that quite yet. I want to settle in for, let's say, no more than 10 more minutes before we move into the church stuff. But what else is profound in the 12 steps that anybody has else to say? Maybe we are ready to move on, but I would love, you know, we're doing our best to talk about surrender and all that. And I'm sure for somebody who hasn't, you know, quite had that brokenness, this is, you know, maybe sounds compelling, but yet, like you said, Keith, how do I do that? you know, kind of thing. So those are some areas. Is there anything else in the other steps that you guys would just say, holy crap, miracles happen when these things there, or I mean, if you want to talk about a crack in which the Spirit comes in and does some stuff, I'd love to at least hear a little bit more about that in any of the steps.
Well, I think step four is one of the most powerful steps. They're all very powerful, and each one is right what is needed at that point. But for me, step four is proven to be a continuous exercise in honesty and self-awareness, which leads to humility, which leads back to more prayer and repentance and gratitude and service. All the things kind of stem from coming out of my fantasy land of how great I am, how right I am, how my will be done. And of course, that's how it should be, because doesn't it make so much sense? And step four is a real paradigm shift.
Bill, before you go on, step four, just remind everybody, that is the inventory, the fearless inventory process of your own life, right?
Yes, made a searching and fearless moral inventory of ourselves. And most people with a religious background would just jump to the conclusion of, well, I know exactly what that is. That means I need to acknowledge that I've committed some sins, and I need to get ready to, you know, confess those. And that's another step, by the way. But in the program, what we look at is motives rather than outcome. And we see that even our addiction itself is a symptom of a very selfish, self-willed, carnal approach to life. And so this fourth step, through certain, it has little steps within it that we can, if we will choose to submit to that process of our own free will and choice with faith in God, the Spirit will sometimes in a very immediate and profound way, and sometimes you have to work at it a bit, but we can fold back that denial and that self-justification and that confusion, because I want what I want so bad and I can't surrender. I can't let go of my agenda because I must have what I want. And this choice to be obedient or adherent to this step really can be quite the awakening in and of itself. Now, it calls for more action, but, you know, I can be so trapped in my will. The more I care about something, the harder it is for me to be honest, because it isn't pleasing to my carnal mind. And so if I can just look at the symptom of suffering, anxiety, stress, and find enough humility to submit to this principle, great things can come. And then now I can go to the Lord, I can go to a sponsor or a bishop, and say, this is what's going on. And I can go to the Lord and say, I want to get rid of this. And I can go to the Lord and say, please take this away. And I can become willing to make amends. I can actually go make amends. I'm in the step process now. Whereas before I was trapped in, why can't I get a break?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So it's a real freedom and it's a real empowerment, step four.
Awesome.
It's something I can do and partake of my own free will and choice, and that's really powerful to me.
Yeah, beautiful. Just for those who, just I'll give a 30 seconds here. Buddhism, the Four Noble Truths, this is the second noble truth. All suffering is caused by desire, and in this case, it's like our desire for the outcome that we want. You can take that second noble truth of Buddhism and put it right here. It works for very interesting ways. Cool. Keith or John, I want Bill to have another chance at any other steps that really kick out, but just to keep the variety of voices going here. Keith or John, any of the others that have just like, this was an ass-kicking part of the 12 steps for me or something?
I would add, if I could, but really every one of them has their own special meaning to me, so I'll go ahead and say it. I've said enough about that part.
Okay. John, anything?
Nope.
Okay. Bill, is there any that you'd want to do before we kind of move into the church's adaptation, strengths and weaknesses, hopes and fears kind of section on of the podcast?
No, I'm ready to move on.
All right. So when did the, who can tell us, when did the church start this ARP with alcohol? Or what does the acronym stand for again? Addiction Recovery Program, right?
Right.
And it's the church's program. I know that there was a precursor, I believe it was in Arizona, called ADAM. Does
right.
anyone know what that acronym stood for?
Alcoholic, drug, addicted Mormon, or something to that effect.
Okay, so there was something that went on there, and my understanding is that's no longer going, but perhaps it was a precursor that sort of, you know, put it in different leaders' minds that addiction really affects Mormons like everything else and stuff. So who can talk me through that transition into the church deciding to jump in?
I'd like to kind of take a shot at this, if you don't mind. I had mentioned you in our pre-conversation, Dan, about after completing my stay at the residential program, I continued to be real involved in their alumni program for a while. And when they would have LDS patients come through treatment, frequently they would call me and ask me to please take them to a meeting that would encourage them in the context of the LDS faith in their recovery. And I did that quite often. And then I got a call a few years after I left that place, and the director said, and I can't give you statistics specifically, but he said that in their review of the ability to stay sober for 1 year after graduation, that they found that the LDS patients had performed very, very poorly compared to what they expected. Indicators for success for a lot of these people were if they had an education, it was helpful. If they had a job waiting for them, it was helpful. If they had strong family support, it was very, very helpful, and you know, other forms of emotional support. And most of the LDS patients had all of those parts of the puzzle in place, and yet the ability to stay sober was low. And they asked me, it was pure speculation on my part, but why would that be? And he did throw in one other finding, and that is in their interviewing these patients, many of them had stopped going to meetings soon after leaving treatment. So these are just my ideas, and I'll just tick off a few of them that occurred to me as I thought about LDS people with Alcoholics Anonymous and recovery.
Okay, please.
And I feel like, and I think Bill sort of addressed this at the beginning, but for one, the meetings I went to in the 90s before all the smoking laws changed frequently were literally smoke-filled rooms with a lot of smoking going on, ubiquitous coffee, quite a bit of profanity, and for your typical traditional LDS person, it was an environment that they would have probably wanted to shun. It felt like the exact environment they wanted to get out of it. And so I think that there were a lot of members who were uncomfortable with Alcoholics Anonymous meetings. The idea of searching out spiritual help from someone who had no priesthood authority and perhaps did not even share your beliefs, like in a sponsor, was kind of alienating for people. This is just my perception. I could be really wrong, but I think the emphasis on self-will and determination kind of left a lot of people in that little trap that they could do this on their own now that they were sober for, you know, a few months or whatever. And I guess now I'm speaking specifically about alcohol and drugs, but a typical alcoholic becomes an alcoholic by drinking more than is healthy for them. But for a member of the church to take the first drink is to cross a moral boundary that they should never experienced alcohol in the first place. And so to admit that you're alcoholic is to say that you've had a moral failing from the get-go. Do you see what I'm saying? The prescription on alcohol makes an LDS alcoholic, not only are they, quote, weak, but they also never should have taken the first drink.
Yeah, an extra layer there of failure.
Right,
yeah.
So they can never set the goal of drinking healthy again or some other fantasy. So I don't know if those ring true to you, Bill, or John, but to me, there were a lot of things that made, let me add one more. Frequently in AA meetings I attended, when someone would bring up any organized religion, there was usually a very strong negative reaction towards organized religion among alcoholics. Maybe many of them had suffered some form of abuse from their religion, spiritual abuse or otherwise. And so as an active member of the church, it could be very uncomfortable to talk about my religion or trials I was experiencing that related to my church. So it wasn't a safe place for a person who was a believing member to really talk about spiritual issues within the church. Ironically, a lot of people within the church have negative reactions towards Alcoholics Anonymous. And so when Bill started off by saying if he could be a bridge builder between these two amazing organizations, that's, I think, something that's really sorely needed. So I just wanted to kind of get those out there to kind of set a context for Mormons in recovery.
Yeah, there's barriers. Yeah, absolutely. Okay, so the church did get into it. We don't need to talk anymore about Adam or as a precursor or whatever. But the church did decide to get into it. And Bill, you are actively working as a called missionary to the ARP program?
Yeah.
Okay. So you're the one who's the most familiar with it. Keith and John, minor familiarity with the ARP?
Yeah, that's personally in my own recovery. That's the only meeting that I've attended for myself.
Okay. So Bill, we'll probably have you be our guide here. But does anybody want to do any disclaimers at first? I know that at least in our pre-conversation, Keith, I've been conversing with you the longest. We all have, I from my own spiritual sense of how the Spirit works in transforming in my own life, as well as from things I've heard from some people, a goal-oriented, perfection-oriented, grace after all we can do. Those things fail for me, and those are going to be at play in some of the things that the church at least started out with. But from what I understand, is everyone here would agree that the church's program is moving in the right direction. I guess I just wanted to say, does anybody want to offer their disclaimers of anything that comes across as a critique here? We're still seeing as a stepping stone in a good direction, and we know that, and we're glad that more members of the church now may try something, you know, even if it's an evolving program, than they would have with those barriers that a typical AA meeting might have.
I agree with that. I think our heart's in the right place here, and we've got a tough work to do, and thankfully, you know, it is the Lord's work, but there's so many prejudices and traditions and fixed ideas in place that it's a challenge, and Latter-day Saints don't traditionally air their dirty laundry, and there's just a lot of things that are foreign to both parties. And so, yeah, we have a lot of barriers and challenges to overcome, but that's why we're doing this, to help. We don't want to tear it down. We want to help it succeed. And I believe we're on the Lord's errand right now. So that's good to say that we are.
Okay, good. Well, then tell, go ahead, please.
Oh, I would just add, Dan, that in the spirit of what both Keith and Bill said, the church needs a 12-step program because there are so many, like was alluded to, there's so many prejudices in place on both parties. Without a 12-step program being administered by the priesthood, a lot of struggling addicts in the church, they just wouldn't have any recourse. They would be lost. So Absolutely. This is a good program.
And it's going to get better, and this is a part of that effort through whatever we might say.
Exactly.
At least that's where our hearts are. So good. Good. Well, I've looked at the church's 12 steps versus the big book's 12 steps. They're really quite close. But would you guys like talk about differences? What's a typical ARP meeting like compared to a typical AA meeting? Is that a good place to start?
You know, for me, I keep in mind the original version. I really think that it was given in the right spirit with the right intent, and I think that, you know, it's easy to, just like we've experienced with the Bible, oh, let's change this, let's change that. Pretty soon it doesn't resemble what it should. So I personally have always just kept the original experience and spirit of the steps in my mind as I teach, as I talk about these things. I don't pay much attention to those changes. That's my personal feeling. And those principles are eternal principles. They shouldn't be trifled with, and we'll probably understand that better in time, but they didn't need to be fixed. I think the motivation behind changes has been anxiety and fear for people getting off track, and I haven't found that to be warranted. And hey, so,
oh, Bill, can you just outline what are the differences? What does the church call for, even if you don't follow the program in your own meetings, versus what an AA meeting's like?
Well, step one is pretty similar. Powerless over our addictions, but they say, of ourselves. Right? They need to put that in there. And that our lives have become unmanageable. Step two says, came to believe. There's a lot of subtle differences, and I don't think we can do it justice.
Yeah, instead of restore to sanity is to restore you to complete spiritual health.
Let's backtrack and say, in the original 12 steps, the 12 steps are the testimony of those people. And it says, we did this and this and this and this and this. Now, in our program, it says you need to do this, and you need to do this, and you need to do this. It's a little bit kind of condescending. It's a little bit controlling. It's a little bit you do this. Now, Bill originally did the same thing, and all the members, as they voted on it, they didn't like it. And he went to a psychiatrist, and he said, well, if you'll just soften up the language and these things, AA's gone through all these learning curves, you know, and now we're kind of doing the same thing. So I don't necessarily go through all the learning curves that everyone else is choosing to go through because it doesn't make sense to me. But the spirit of what they're trying to accomplish is good. Let's see. One of the things in step five, it says, well, in step four, they add the word written, and I think that's fair. But that's an assumption that anything less would be unacceptable. But they've added that to give further clarification. In step five, they added, in addition to confessing to God, self, and another person, they also added priesthood authority. Well, in the big book itself, it says if you are a member of an organized religion, you will want to confess to your authorized leader. So these are things that were taught in AA, but if you don't know all that, you add it into the steps thinking that if, you know, you don't say it, nobody's going to feel the need to go see their bishop for step five. Well, that's silly. That, I think.
Right.
So they added that, and I don't know. Step six is pretty similar. Become entirely ready to have God remove your shortcomings. And in step seven, it says, humbly ask him to remove. They changed the language, the terms, character defects versus shortcomings versus character weaknesses. We changed some of the language, and to me, it seems a little like we're trying to be nice. And we don't want to say anything that might be damage anyone's self-esteem or something. And sometimes, you know, in AA they say if you baby them, you bury them. And I really believe that. I'm not a hardcore, tough love kind of a guy, but, I mean, it's worked for me sometimes to tell somebody what they really need to hear. But I think sometimes as Christians, we tend to go overboard the other way, being trying to be so nice and sweet and optimistic.
Right.
And an addict is, in brand new in recovery, it tends to be so delusional and grandiose and you know, that, you know, tiptoeing around his ego is the last thing he needs. So,
yeah.
You know, some of the things that we do are typical behavior of well-intending religious people, and we soften it and water it down a little bit. But I don't know, the 10th step is continue to take personal inventory, and when we were wrong, promptly admitted it. That's pretty much the same. Step 11 says we sought through prayer and study of the scriptures and pray to know the will of God and to have the power to carry it out. That's the ARP version versus the AA version says sought through prayer and meditation to improve our conscious contact with God as we understood him, praying only for knowledge of his will for us and the power to carry that out. And there's some differences there.
Yeah.
And they're there for a reason, but we had to change that. And step 12 talks a little bit about having had a spiritual awakening through the atonement versus through the process of the steps and accessing the atonement. We try to practice these principles, and I really do not have the ARP version memorized.
I'm looking at it. You're doing a pretty good job. I'm looking at them side by side, and we can certainly link to them.
But the 12 step doesn't really emphasize the need to help other addicts. It just talks about helping others and kind of carrying the message of the atonement or missionary work. And of course we must do that. But I feel for myself a real stewardship there with those who still suffer that only addicts like me can accomplish. And so I don't want to move away from that and leave that dirty work for someone else so I can be in the mainstream of the church and pretend like it never happened.
Right, and especially leave it for somebody who hasn't the experience to really be effective.
Yes. Yes.
Let's talk about that. I know, Keith, when you and I began to talk, that was one of the big issues. We're thinking a little bit, we're starting to discuss, why is the church acting, you know, why is the church changing the way we did? And one of your thoughts, at least, and I'll let you go ahead and say it rather than me, but it's simply this issue of how can we relinquish control to addicts, working with addicts the way AA does. Do you want to kind of flesh that out?
Well, I feel like with Alcoholics Anonymous, it's an amazing organization because it has very few rules and it's a very fluid depending on the individual home group and kind of how they choose to adopt the program. But that just doesn't work very well in a centrally organized church that's mission is to carry the gospel to the whole world. And so often what we find is things come from Salt Lake down. In my discussions with a dear friend of mine who is a missionary to this program, he helped me to see the amount of innovation and creativity that is coming from the ground up. But I can't speak for the church, but I imagine that to try and administer a program in so many locations, the only, you know, command and control is really the only model that has ever worked before. And so I think a lot of those decisions just are made, you know, from the top down. I have no idea at all if there's any validity to this concern, but when AA scrupulously avoids attaching itself to any outside organization or any hospital, other people may adopt their principles, but not the other way around. And I don't know if there are liability issues that the church has to consider in running an alcohol addiction program in a church building under the auspices of the priesthood. And I don't know, I'm in no position to be wise enough to know the issues that they face centrally, but certainly the feel that I have when I'm in an AA meeting is very much this group kind of runs its own thing and does it the best they can and the feel I have with the church program is a lot more, these are the guidelines, and try and stay with them as best you can. I don't know, Bill, if you want to comment on that.
Well, can I just say,
go ahead, John.
Well, that maybe the central difference, right, Dan, that the if you go to an AA meeting, it can be any sort of meeting. It might be a reading that's heavy on readings from the big book. It might be a meeting where everybody reports on their sobriety. It may be a step-heavy meeting where they go through each step one by one. And so maybe the defining features of one is lack of structure, and defining features of the other is structure. Yeah, the church wants to, you know, in a sort of ward model or stake model, you know, it's we're going to do the exact same thing in every single group around the country. And, you know, I'm not a missionary like Bill is, but I know that the missionary in the group that I attended would pull out a piece of paper and very mechanically would go through the agenda that the brethren had set for what we were able to discuss and what we were not able to discuss. And some of those decisions that they made in Salt Lake may reflect very well the recovery of some people, but for me, I found it stifling and frustrating, some of the things that we weren't allowed to do in our meetings.
Terrific. Bill, do you want to talk about that tension, and do you agree with Keith that that's the reasons why the church is doing it? Is it a hangover, or is it a desire that correlation happen? That kind of thing.
I think it's I mean, I can totally relate to what he's sharing and how he feels about that. And I think those of us who are familiar with some of the other programs out there, you know, can see that to have only one format is limiting. On the other hand, I mean, I would love to have some speaker meetings or some topic discussion meetings. And I believe that we're going to come to this conclusion. Again, we're going to, you know, take a long time to figure out the obvious, because we're looking through a Mormon lens, and that's just, this is so foreign to our culture, and that's
right.
I think as it should be. The mainstream church does not cater to addicts in recovery, but they're trying to help us and include us, and I'm grateful for that. Now, here's the thing I think that really matters, and that is that you have nothing if you do not have men or women, whatever, helping. If you don't have one addict helping another, passing it on, and increasing in numbers exponentially as it naturally, like it did in AA, if we don't have that, it won't matter what our format is. If we don't have one man sponsoring another man, passing on what he has, and having that man passing it on to another, and pretty soon you've got 20 guys that know what they're talking about, it really won't matter what the format is. If that meeting has those brothers in there and taking those new guys in and taking them under their wing and taking them outside of that meeting and working the steps with them, because the bulk of the work goes on outside the meeting. The meetings are really a very small part of it. But this is something we have to take into our lives and into our hearts. And if when that happens, this very same format that we find so stifling and frustrating now becomes different, because the brothers that are sharing from experience, they're sharing in the spirit, they're sharing in love, they're sharing in inviting that new guy to come and join them. Now it's different. And so that's what I see. The brethren, whoever is in charge, what they need to see is us addicts, recovering addicts, helping others recover. And it is wonderful to see them come back into full fellowship in the church. And, or in the case of the sex addict who's been fully active all along, you know, to have him be doing so worthily. You know, these are wonderful things to see. But unless we're seeing those kinds of changes in individual lives, then it's counterfeit. It's not, you know, the rubber hasn't met the road yet. And I think that's what we see happening now, is people grabbing hold of these things like the big book and sponsors and people with some long-term sobriety and saying, how did you do that? Now, that really does bring results. It's amazing how easily transmitted it is from one addict to another. When one party is experienced and the other one's truly, sincerely ready. If you get that together, I would say that 9 times out of 10, you're going to have 2 sober addicts when you're done instead of 1.
Now, I guess the question I have is for Bill or Keith or Dan, is that I'm really encouraged by what Bill's saying, but I wonder if that model is really available when the, I guess my experience with the addiction and recovery program model is that you have a missionary who's been called by the stake, who's a high priest who's served a long time in the church, and then you have a bunch of addicts sitting around a table, and it feels like you have a teacher and then students, and this rather than I love how Bill described it. It feels so organic, but my experience with ARP is that we're supposed to look to this guy as our model in recovery when he might not have ever done the steps at all.
Yeah. And there is, again, when you have some solid sponsor material and mentors in the group, I think that, and you need a good missionary. The missionary, we're still learning. How does the missionary really be the priesthood authority and preside in that meeting while still being able to correctly defer humbly to that facilitator who is the experienced recovering addict? Now, that, I think that's where we see some trouble, is that our facilitators are not always experienced either. Now you've really got a double whammy there of inexperience.
Right.
Now, when we get new missionaries, I always challenge them to read the AA Big Book. Well, if I was calling these brethren, I would make it a requirement. But I just suggest to the ones I associate with that they'll serve better if they, and they'll understand the program better if they read that Big Book. But, you know, there's a lot of things that only time will tell. And again, if it's not meant to be, it'll dwindle and be gone in a few years. And if it is meant to be, then I think we will see miracles. And I feel a heavy burden of responsibility in trying to help that change. I think we're, as addicts, we're real quick to find fault and get discouraged and give up. I know I feel that way on these matters. I can think, these guys are never going to get a clue. They're never going to let us have free rein. And, but, you know, I was around when they had the ATOM program, and we have come so far. The Lord is working. He is helping these non-addict missionaries, you know, slowly but surely. And they need to learn about addiction because they have children and cousins and family.
Right.
There's no nobody that doesn't know an addict hardly anymore. And for them, right. They don't want to come out of their bubble. But they're going to have to.
Wow, that's neat. Do you guys know, is the church open to somebody who may be listening to this podcast who has a member of the, somebody who says, you know, I want to reach out to that person in love. Are they open to people calling themselves or saying, please consider me for this calling because of I want the education process myself? You know, just to be there in a different way than I am now with my loved one.
The missionary position is a service position. It's a service mission. It's a volunteer mission. They do call people, but ideally the Lord would call them through the Spirit. They would have a desire to serve, and they'd go and talk to somebody. That's what I did. Hey, I want to help do this because they need the help.
Awesome.
Another problem, Dan, though, with that approach, and you see this problem in the ARP program, is it becomes a venue for a lot of, you know, what you might call tourists who come in and they see a brother from the ward and they say, hey, I'm here to support so-and-so. Who are you here to support? And then you hang your head in shame and you're like, I'm an addict, you know?
Oh, wow. Yeah.
Yeah.
I'd like to add to that, Dan, that in conversing with one of my good friends who's a recovering addict, I asked him if he had participated in the ARP program or the passages. And he said, I believe he said he went to 2 meetings and they were both conducted near in his stake or seminary. In both cases, leaders from his ward, like the Relief Site president, did exactly what John just said. They came and said, "Hey, how are you doing? It's good. Wow, who are you here to support?" And he was he felt like his anonymity was kind of shot. And even in visiting with my friend who serves in a missionary calling here in this area, he encouraged, I think you got an email, Dan, to the effect that maybe we would understand this program. You would, for example, by visiting the meetings. And I'm not sure. Right. Could you tell us, Bill, are there any restrictions on who can participate in terms of protecting the anonymity of the brothers and sisters?
There's no restrictions. There's anonymity is strongly encouraged. But even in AA, you know, it's understood that if you don't want this possibly be heard somewhere else, you better not say it, because we just don't have that kind of control.
Right.
Now, I haven't had any horror stories of anybody showing up, but I do think that we are pioneers and we're breaking new ground here, and there may be some wounds to our ego and pride, but I believe that, well, for me, you know, it gets a lot easier in time. The new person is very shy and isn't ready. Like one of my guys says, I'm not ready to wear the T-shirt, you know, and I can understand, you know, I don't want to go out and tell the world I'm an addict, but I really haven't had a lot of problems. And I think a lot of the priesthood leaders that have come have really been humbled by the honesty. And I think I'm confident they've been respectful. Now, I've been to some meetings where there'll be a sister come, and they're always a little bit warm and fuzzy. I don't know. but you know.
You're talking a non-addict sister, you're saying.
Yes. Yeah, yeah. Oh, yeah. Who are you here to support, you know? And it's like they're shocked by the fact that they know somebody that's an addict, but they didn't know they were an addict, and
right.
They can't comprehend it. Well, we have to break these things down. We all know addicts.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. We are in such early stages of these kinds of issues, but, you know, I think the choice to go to other meetings, if it's really a bother to an individual, that's a valid choice. I always encourage the people to do both. You know, you need to get some seasoned recovery in an AA-type setting or an SA-type setting, but if you're hoping to integrate back into the church, you know, the ARP program is a real good vehicle for that. And in doing those things, they're going to help the program, the ARP program, mature and be strengthened.
Yeah, and I know we're right on the edge of when Bill said he needs to end. So Bill, are there things that are left sort of on your notepad or whatever it is that you brought to this that you'd want to share in closing before you have to take off?
Well, no, I'm just trying to participate in this conversation, and I know I was one of those guys that took offense at the changes they made in the steps and took offense at the meddling of non-addict priesthood leadership in our meetings. How dare them, you know, and I'm not even going to go to that program. I'm sticking with AA. I was one of those guys, you know, up till a few years ago. And now I'm just trying to help these things change instead of being one of the ones that criticize it or naysayers. I really feel we have a real need as Latter-day Saints in recovery. And I always have felt the need for my sponsor to understand my spirituality as well as him understand my addiction. And I think until we can kind of break through some of these barriers, those statistics that are very real will continue. And I know as an addict who's active in the church and active in the program, just experience a lot of joy and a lot of gratitude and want others who may be trapped where I was, you know, to offer them that way out. And so I just, you know, I'm glad you guys are doing this and I encourage, you know, those of you that are participating in the meetings or the opportunity to do so to do what you can to help it be better, because there's so many stumbling blocks. As we've talked about, those are very real. But I think that they're going to have to go away for the program to continue. They're going to have to those poor non-addict missionaries, think of how they must feel trying to learn and to relate to people and that level of honesty. But the ones that I've seen do well have really been impressed, and they, I think, have been increased in their spirituality. Isn't that something?
Right.
When the dregs of society can actually, turn out to be somebody that can really make a positive, contribution to the church. That's a wonderful thing. That's the Lord's way.
I love it. Any thing that you, John or Keith, that you have to ask Bill, to ask him something that you may know of his story or something that you want to quickly have him fill out before he drops off?
I just want to say how very, very grateful I am that you are on here, Bill. You're very well spoken, and I love your passion. And you remind me of so many people I know through AA who have that. I think you're very much a kindred spirit. So thank you for sharing today.
Thanks.
Now it's starting to sound like an AA meeting. Thanks for sharing, Ben.
Are you ready for a hug?
Well, we do. We have something special in the program, and I think that somebody mentioned they wish their quorum could be more like that, and I share that sentiment. We've been beaten into that state of reasonableness and teachableness. And so we can't toot our horns too loud, but the fruits of that have been so good. And so, yeah, I'm grateful to share that with you guys, and keep up the good work.
Well, thank you. Thank you. And we will we'll figure out a way with this anonymity thing. Part of what we do here, Bill, is we have this is a podcast, but there's also a blog, and there'll be comments that will come, and I'm hoping that we can figure out a way to invite you to at least engage with people as they ask questions or whatnot, and we'll figure out a way to get anonymous emails or something that shows up if you are willing to engage us a little bit after the podcast launches tomorrow.
Sure. Just let me know.
Well, thank you. We'll just let you go ahead and just, if you hang up your phone, you'll drop off the call, and Keith and John and I will go on for another 10, 15 minutes or whatever. There's just a couple of things that are on my my notepad to still want to try.
Okay.
But thank you so much.
Thanks again.
You bet. Bye, guys.
Bye.
Bye.
Hey, Dan, let me say one thing about anonymity. And I heard someone justifiably complain that when the program is too anonymous, you can't find the other addicts, and you can feel like you're lost. And I could tell this in a 5-minute version, but I'll tell the 1-minute version. We moved from one community to another about 15 miles apart. And in the first community we lived, I became quite good friends with the fellow who was in our stake, and we had similar callings. And I just loved this guy. He was the coolest guy, and got to know him, I would have to say superficially, but over a long period of time. And then one day he was going to a meeting, and as addiction had brought him to this point, and as he reached for the handle to open the door, he looked through the window and saw me sitting in there. We had moved away. And he told me that he recoiled and thought, I cannot go in there. I do not want this guy knowing about me. And then as he tells the story, another month went by with tremendous suffering and more addiction and more pain. And then he went through a treatment program, and they were saying, who can you find to help you? And he started wishing that he could see me, not because of anything I could say, but because we knew each other. And so when he came to that same meeting a couple of months later, and I actually came in late to that meeting, and so he was already seated. So when I walked in the room and I saw this guy who I knew well, my instant reaction was, oh my gosh, not him. It was just a very normal human reaction. And then within literally less than 2 or 3 seconds, I felt this warm feeling of love inside of me. Like, I know this guy better now than I ever knew. I haven't heard him say a word, but I know him better than I ever knew him when we were just serving in similar callings, And it's really actually, the anonymity can be overblown, because it's really an incredible blessing when you run into a cousin or a former ward member or someone, and you find out that you're sharing a similar struggle. And I can't explain it, except the love is just instantaneous.
That's beautiful. Thank you. Cool. Hey, you guys, as far as talking about the church program, let's do a few more things. And I have a couple questions. One thing is just a matter of clarification. I don't want to get too far away, and I should have hit Bill up. He kept saying a man teaching a man. You know, he was using a lot of male language. Is there something in the church's program or even in AA where you don't have a sponsor, you don't sponsor somebody of the opposite sex?
Right. I think that's very much a general guideline. And there are female-only meetings for women struggling with certain addictions. There are mixed meetings. There are also, these are some of the innovations in the area, in one area of the church, where they also have couples meetings where recovering couples go together, which can be an incredible method of helping to get a reality check on the issues that you're facing as a marriage. I think they're working on some pilots for a youth program. So, but yeah, some meetings are mixed. But when it comes to sponsorship, you usually are very much encouraged to not set yourself up for a major failure. So try and find someone who, you know, same faith if possible, but definitely the same gender.
Okay, great. Thank you. That's a good clarification. I just don't want, you know, anyone to think it's just, yeah, the old sexist language, you know, kind of
yeah.
man standing for, you know, humanity and right. either sex. Another couple things. It sounds like the church's program is a pretty good, I mean, each meeting is, you might have sex addicts along with alcohol, drug addicts, all the different gambling things sort of treated as one. Do you guys find that helpful? Is there enough similarities between the different addictions that that's good? And or is the church starting to do more focused ones on a particular type of addiction?
That's not the case. Actually, the ARP program is primarily for alcohol and drugs. And then the one I think is called Passages is a meeting primarily for pornography and masturbation and sexual compulsions. And then there are many other programs, women with sex and love addiction or overeaters. My friend who's a missionary says that the church right now doesn't have a very strong program for gambling, so he tends to refer people to GA with gambling problems. So the church is finding more and more niches, and maybe this would be a good place for John to talk about the value of storytelling and how this simple process can be so therapeutic and so helpful.
Love it.
It. When we have things in common with people in the room.
Right. Well, this is a conversation that Keith and I have had together often. Why did it branch off from AA? And I'm no historian. I think the first group was something like Narcotics Anonymous was the branch off. But addiction can tie a lot of people together. But I've found that with a particular, with particular addictions, it's much easier to relate to people of your same persuasion, especially something in the church as shameful as sex addiction. I really wouldn't feel comfortable disclosing, you know, what my week has been like in a room with, say, my Relief Society president, so who may be an overeater, for example. So that seems to be an important principle.
Okay, well, and I do want you to talk about storytelling, but right there you did open the door to another issue that I know we ought to talk about, and that is the accountability that you generally find, at least what you guys have shared with me, at some meetings that are not the church ones, of here is my accounting for the week. This is how long it has been for me. Here's where I've slipped up. And it seems like the church doesn't welcome that sort of inventory in front of your peers the way other meetings do. Is that true? Or
right. And that was my one of my frustrations with the ARP program is the principles, you know, the 12 steps are exactly what's needed, but there also needs to be a place of safe disclosure where you can, you know, go through your successes and your failures. In a traditional Alcoholics Anonymous meeting, you get tokens for amount of time that you've stayed sober. And I'm not a missionary, but talking to the missionary in charge of our group, I kept trying to push our group towards, you know, accountability. Can we use this time to talk about our successes and even our failures of the last week? So that, I mean, for me, there's a lot of people, you know, in the church that I'm expected to talk to when I screw up. I'm supposed to talk to my wife. I'm supposed to talk to my bishop and whoever else I've harmed. But it depends, you know, on who your bishop is. But, you know, a sex addiction, it's not something, it's not news that's going to be received very well by your wife. And I just found it to be so liberating to be in a room of sympathetic men who nodded their head with me and even wept with me as I recounted some of my failures of the last week. And then, you know, the missionary in charge of our meeting.
Just a second. Little Messiah 18 right there, huh? Mourn with those who mourn, rejoice with, et cetera. Huh? That's true living that, isn't it?
Right. You know, and I had a great missionary, but we kind of, you know, he said, look, we're not supposed to recount our failures in these meetings. We have an agenda. Let's stick to that. And what disappointed me is that it ended up feeling like, I don't know, Sunday school or something, where we have these principles and let's talk about them abstractly. And let's all assume that we've been sober the whole week. And there's really no barometer to know if this is working for anybody, because everyone just comes in and smiles and says, yeah, let's talk about the eighth step, you know, and then we do these readings and we talk about the readings. But as far as what's going on in the lives of these addicts and how it's working and how it's not working and what's going on there, there's just, as Bill said earlier, there's just some barriers that need to be overcome so that we can culturally become more comfortable with that level of disclosure, that level of honesty, even when it's ugly. Like you said, Dan, that's kind of where the gospel is.
Just when you said people weeping with you, and I imagine they also rejoice with you, and so that just reminded me of it's exactly what the covenant is, you know, the baptismal covenant. Oh, crazy. So I just really, there is such a spiritual core here, and I hope that's coming across in this podcast, because I know I feel it, and I've lived with this sort of idea of the spirituality of addiction and recovery and the processes that are at the heart of it for years now, and I just would love other people to dive in and discover that as much as they can. But I do want to talk about storytelling. So it is part of the storytelling is not only telling your life story, but it is telling your week story. And what is it? What is about the power of that? I know it was mentioned big time in the Krista Tippett thing that storytelling is a big part of AA.
Well, I would just recommend to all the listeners The Spirituality of Imperfection, Modern Wisdom from Classic Stories. It's a book by Ernest Kurtz and Catherine Ketchum, which it draws on stories from all sorts of different religious traditions, but what it feels like it keeps coming back to is Alcoholics Anonymous. But what's fascinating about Alcoholics Anonymous is the simplicity of the formula. It goes as simple as this. And to Mormon listeners, I mean, is this not, I guess, what a testimony is supposed to be? The first step is you say, this is what I was like. This is what my life was like. The next step is you say, this is what happened to me. And then the third step is you say, and now this is what my life is like today. And that simple process, I mean, that's, you're not going to get a Pulitzer Prize for fiction with a story like that, but it's so powerful for you as the storyteller and then for everyone else as the listener. Again, you're not preaching, you know, and I noticed, and Dan, I can be too negative, I know, but one of the main differences between the Big Book 12 Steps and the ARP 12 Steps is the Big Book is just descriptive, you know. We sought to whatever, you know, we realized and then this happened. And in the ARP program, it's in the imperative mood,
right,
you know,
right.
Do this and then do this and then do that and then you'll recover. Storytelling is a lot more passive, you know. I have no agenda. I'm not telling you what you need to be doing. All I'm doing is saying, this is my experience. And the invitation in a 12-step meeting is to find, as we said earlier, find those areas of sympathy where our hearts reach out to the person sharing. And we find those places of mutual experience.
Yes, thank you. Keith, I want to involve you here. I do
On John's point there, I've shared with both of you the encounter with the person who came into the Sunstone office that sort of really alerted me to the church's program, and it relates a little bit to the imperative mode or the different approach there. Is this a good time to share it, or Keith, did you want to jump on something on storytelling first?
I'll just say one more thing about storytelling, and that is, being a stubborn and willful person that I am, when someone wants to get a point across to me, but they simply share their story, there's really no argument that I can form to say that's not really your story, and so it lowers my defenses and allows me to listen and to see if I want to model that behavior or not. There's no compulsion. And so as I've experienced that, I found that's also the most effective way. And that one of the bylines is, you don't give advice, but frequently I find myself in a meeting when someone's confronting a challenging situation, and my mind goes back in my own experience to the same challenging situation, it's very appropriate for me to say, well, when I was in this exact situation, these are the things that I did and they didn't work, and these are the things I did and they did work. That does kind of sound like advice, but I'm not asking you to do anything. I'm just sharing with you what happened. And right. I think that really actually is very inviting to lower conflict and open people's minds and their hearts. So that's all I wanted to add.
Terrific. Terrific. Well, let me just share with the listeners, you guys, I shared it with you and you could relate. And then actually, Keith, I appreciate the fact, because I shared it in an email with this friend that you've talking about who's working in the program and you know, really thinks it's on the right track and stuff like that. And this person assured us through the email that it isn't still happening, at least the way I'm going to share it here. So I'm perfectly open to the fact that this is no longer the case. But I'm going to share quickly the experience of this person who came and said, here's why Sunstone should have some sessions on this, and here's where I think the church's program is doomed for failure, because I think it really opens us up into the something more of this spiritual core of what's at the heart of addiction. So the basic story for the listeners is, a fellow came in, Sunstone, you know, here's an experience that I've been having. I've been going to the churches. It was back in, at least in 2008. I don't know how long this person had been going to the meetings, but I left Sunstone in 2008, and I believe this was the summer before I left. And he basically says, I'm going to these meetings, and I think that they're, because of the desire to control and to teach rather than allow a free flow sharing or whatever, we've got something going on there that I think will never work. And his point was, for instance, that one of the ones that he shared, he says, the approach there to humility is to teach it the way we teach it at church. The humility step is step 7. So the church has a lesson that says, this is the step we're focusing on this week, and it's humility. And he said they would basically open with prayer. Here's me. Here's humility. Here's it as a goal. Let's read some statements from the brethren about how important humility is. And yeah, anybody have any feedback on these? Great. And then let's move on. And it was sort of like, set a goal to be more humble. And he says, what he in his own recovery and through AA had learned is that humility, yeah, it's a goal, but it's really a fruit. You don't become humble by setting a goal to be humble. You become humble through the brokenness and the inviting Christ into your life, or the higher power, or whatever it is, into your life, and allowing that to emerge as a fruit of the transformed heart, rather than something that you can achieve it by just working harder at it. And so for him, there was still that model of, if we just really buckle down to it, guys, we can set that goal and we can achieve it. And he felt like that was going on with all the steps. So you guys seem to relate at least to that story, but I think we're all open to Keith, your friend, saying it's no longer quite taught that way. Any reactions at this point?
Sure, thanks. First of all, I will tell you there are a lot of lame AA meetings too, and a lot of
good.
There's a lot of crazy people in other aspects of recovery, and there are some very bizarre things that are said. So that's part of being human beings and full of our egos and stuff. So that's not your friend who came to the office could have had the same experience with some other forum than the church one. But my friend wrote me an email saying, if that same thing were to happen today, I'm kind of reading his words, you'd be in a circle welcomed by a group leader who may or may not have had experience with addiction. So he's pointing out the missionary, followed by an opening prayer, reading of the mission statement, and then a shared reading of humility from the ARP guide, which is very much like your friend said. The guide has some principles taught in a few paragraphs, then a few statements, and then some scriptures and areas to fill in. It's like a workbook. The group leader will then turn the time over to the facilitator, who is a recovering addict. The facilitator shares an experience from his or her life in regards to humility and bears testimony of the role of Jesus Christ in this process, step 7. The facilitator then reads a few guidelines for sharing, including a fairly strong statement of confidentiality and anonymity, at which most of the members of the group will vocalize, "Hear, hear." It's kind of a little, almost like a chant, like that. Before turning the sharing time over to individuals in the group to share their thoughts, feelings, emotions, experiences, etc. There's usually 3 to 5 minutes allotted for each person. Each person identifies themselves by their first name and is free to pass if they prefer not to share. The meeting ends with a closing comment by the group leader and then a closing prayer. So this would be a topic meeting. It just depends on how you define goal-oriented. I mean, you probably pick the hardest quality or attribute in which to set goals, because this is truly a fruit. But if a person were new to the program that week, I think it might be very disorienting, because this is step 7. And that's also true of any other recovery group. If they're not starting at step 1, they could come in and be a little disoriented on what led to this particular step. So they should be taken in order, and that's where a sponsor can be helpful, because not everybody's going to come in to a group at the time the group's starting to go back through the workbook, you know. But that's not really different than what your friend said, except in how it's described. But I think that this did emphasize people sharing from their own experience, and I think that's the most important part, not from their head, but from their heart.
Right. Good. Do you have anything to share on that, John? I want to take us one more. There's like a step from here to a point I'm hoping to dive into for a sec, but anything at this point?
Take us there.
Okay. Well, the second point is, you guys also saw it in my email there, about this idea of a fruit, which really, to me, it's all over the Book of Mormon. It's all over the DNC. I do think there's a spiritual truth there. And again, I think what you just said there, Keith, reminded me of truly what you're saying. You know, there are six steps before you'd get to something like humility, before you would get to a fruit of the Spirit. And those first three are a total reorientation of you and who you are and your will and all that different stuff. I've shared it probably once in this history of this podcast for over nine months that I've taken over this podcast, but there's that beautiful passage of King Benjamin that just totally nails this. It's simply that idea, when you get into the beggar will not put up his petition to you in vain. You know, you will not suffer your children to go hungry. You will not, you know, do all these different things. They can sound like commands, but when you look at what's going on there in King Benjamin, Mosiah 4, it is completely the opposite. You start diving in around verse 7 or 8 or whatever it is on believe in God. And I loved what Bill said earlier about when I was talking about one of the steps. He goes, well, you know, it's really not quite that stage 6 Fowler stuff. It's just like, just believe that God's in charge. You know, just believe that God's running the world. That's enough for this step to get you going. And so I just love that. In Mosiah 4, it says that. It says, believe in God. Believe that God knows more than you. You know, believe that God, you know, has some care and concern for you. Believe, you know, remember those moments. I loved hearing again from one of you guys about Bill Wilson remembering moments within his life of, you know, God trying to send a message and having these minor spiritual experiences. So the Mosiah 4 says, remember these things. Remember the goodness of God. Remember this, 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 and this. And then the transition is, and if you do this, if you get in this right little sensibility of who God is, who you are, you know, stuff like that, then guess what? As a natural result, you won't have your children go hungry. You'll desire naturally to live peaceably. You will never let the beggar put up his petition to you in vain, because you're fed, and these things that were to do flow out of you because you've settled into that right relationship. Does that make sense? And I really think that's what's going on, at least from what I can tell over these last years of sort of engaging this addiction and recovery idea of, I really think that is the beauty of what we're doing. Certainly there's those steps, and they're all hard work, and they all desire focus and all that stuff. But I think those first three put you in that position to where you are naturally, like Bill said, you naturally want to share with another addict what you've learned. You've naturally, you know, want to reach out to your ecclesiastical leader, you know, perhaps. You would naturally want to make amends to these people rather than having be a chore. If you've really gotten into that mode of those first three, I think you're really, they do flow as a fruit. So that was just an area I want to take. Do you guys have any experience with that, or am I off base?
No, I think you're very much on in saying that. And I think since we're emphasizing the steps so much, which I enjoy and appreciate, sometimes I work with someone and maybe there is really something that's so traumatic in their past that when they get to the fourth step, there may be some anger or resentment that's just too big to tackle. And it may they may stop. And Bill might disagree with this, but what I would say to that person is just ask yourself, how free do you want to be? And based on that answer, then you can decide how much of the fourth step you want to take this go around. And we can still go forward, even though you've left some really ugly things behind. And let's go through and then we'll come back around. Because if it's a severe a lifetime of sexual abuse or violent background or something like that, the death of a sibling, it may be your fault or something that could be so scarring.
Wow,
some people just cannot possibly, they may go and drink or they may act out again. And so I just remember in one of the fellowships, someone just saying, the only step you really have to take perfectly is step one. The others, it's a process, and just write it in your brain, how free do you want to be, and then choose that degree of freedom and work the steps and then realize that you're going to come back around and try it again, you know?
That's wonderful. I love that. Yes. And then, you know what? Somewhere in, I think it was in your notes to us, progress, not perfection. Let's talk about that with the Mormon mindset a little bit, and then let's head right to a close, unless you guys have other things on your thing. Would you, whoever was it that put that in their email?
That was me, Keith. I would just say that that phrase comes straight out of the Big Book. We believe in progress and not perfection. And I'm not denying the Sermon on the Mount or, you know, the sermon in the New World. Although I'm sure, Dan, you're very, very much more informed than I, but there's different ways to look at the word perfection as completeness and so forth. But for an alcoholic, the idea of doing things perfectly when you're screwed up so much, and I say alcoholic as a generic, an addict, a sex addict or whatever, when you've messed up in so many ways, and then you look at the overwhelming need to fix all these things, and it can become very overwhelming and self-defeating right from the get-go. And so I just love that phrase from the Big Book that progress is very acceptable, because perfection, as we know in Moroni 10:32, it's not ours to have anyway. It's through Jesus Christ that we become perfect. That's not a goal either. It's a turning of our heart, more or less. But another thing that I wish I could take credit, but someone pointed out, the concept of endure to the end, a very, very true principle. But when you're trying to make it for the next 3 hours without acting out.
Yeah. Like, that's like one moment at a time.
Just,
thank you.
Just, run me over right now. It's over. I'm done, you know. And so it's, you know, one day at a time seems corny, but I've talked to many people. I've said it to myself. I give you permission to act out tomorrow. You are totally permitted to. Just don't do it today. If you could just make it through the day tomorrow, you can do whatever you want. Surprisingly, most of the time tomorrow doesn't seem like such a good idea. You know, so I don't need to think, oh my gosh, I've got a millennium of this to do and I can't do it. It's when you've screwed up enough times like I have, it's just easier to take it in small bites.
Great. Fantastic. John, any thoughts on progress, not perfection, endure to the end, one day at a time, anything?
Well, I know I can speak from the outside first and then from the inside. This is a mantra of Alcoholics Anonymous that bothered me as the son of an addict, because I'd want to hear my father declare, it's over, that was the last time, it's not going to happen again. And it was frustrating to hear him say, you know, that's just not within my power to make a statement of that right now. I guess it comes back to the humility.
Wow, beautiful.
You know, and then now I'm on the other side of the coin, and I hear people in my family saying, will you give this up forever? You know, and that doesn't, if I'm going to be true to the 12 steps, it's not a promise that I can responsibly make. It's, and I don't really know how to say it better than Keith said it. It's one day at a time. It's so simple, but that's really the only amount of sobriety that I can handle at any given moment.
Yeah. It was interesting. I was talking to my own family just, you know, this was, podcast was coming up, and it was like, why is it that alcoholics always say, I am still an alcoholic? I'm in recovery, but I'm always in it. And I was at least trying to say, I think it's for what we guys were just talking about here, right? You can't, you know, you can't ever declare. It's something you have to work on every day.
Right. It's, I do go to meetings, and you could argue this. This is where you move into the head instead of the heart, but some people will say, hi, my name is Fred, and I am a child of God. And so it's an affirmation of their eternal value. And I think that there is kind of the counterpoint to, I am an alcoholic. However, I actually feel a little bit more refreshed when someone comes broken. Not that we're not all children of God. I guess I'm looking for the link that makes that connection with you and me strong. But I just know that my own relatives really rejected the idea that certain people can say they're alcoholics and they'll always be alcoholics. That's just not a mental model that a lot of people I grew up around can really understand.
Right. But it's important is what, I mean, you sounds like your family's agreeing with my family, or at least wondering, but yet you're kind of arguing that it is important to stay in that mode of recovery.
We could go on a long riff on this one, and I don't know how long you want to go, but
okay.
Alma the Younger,
yeah, not much longer. Yeah, thanks.
Alma the Younger didn't forget what happened to him. So in his counseling, his sons Helaman and Shiblon, he briefly shared his bottom with them and taught them what it took for him to get through that and to use the Jesus prayer, Jesus Christ, you know, please redeem me. And what happened?
Yeah.
So he didn't forget what happened. But when he gets to Corianthony, he has a different message, because that's not what he feels Corianthony needs to hear. And there he starts teaching him principles about restitution, restoration. And then I love how he ends by saying, now let these things bother you no more. Just let your sins bother you with that bother, the 10th step, which brings you to repentance. Admit when you're wrong and quickly address it, you know. So each child needs something different, if I'm reading Alma right. But we can't forget.
Awesome. That's great. What do you guys have left? Anything that you really wanted to say today that we haven't had the chance yet?
I guess the takeaway that I have from this conversation, from the 12-step program, is that this is, for me, the avenue that I've found the deepest resources of spirituality. And, you know, it may sound strange to say that you find God when you're most distant from Him, but that has really been my experience, that my addiction has opened my mind to the reality that I'm not God, and that this is something that I can't manage my life, and that I need God to be in charge of my daily affairs. And that can sound really embarrassing and really humiliating, but it's something that I can say, and I get that from these 12 steps that Bill W. and Dr. Bob came up with, you know, in Ohio all those years ago. I guess I just encourage people, if this is something that you're struggling with, there is the ARP program. There are Alcoholics Anonymous, Narcotics Anonymous programs if you live in a city all around where you're at, and it's something that you don't need to shy away from. In my experience and Bill's experience and Keith's experience, this is very, very complementary to the gospel that we find in the LDS Church.
Cool. Thank you for that story and testimony and just that it's a process that ends in joy, or at least not even ending, but it has joy along with the hard work. So that's neat. Hey, that did remind me, though, Keith, you and I talked a little bit. There is another program called Heart to Heart that we probably ought to mention. So for those who may not, you know, again, we're just trying to throw out the options here. There's Alcoholics Anonymous and all the NAs and SAs and all the different things there that are not the church program. The church has several programs. You mentioned a few of those, Keith. And so those would be able to be found, and I'll send a link to the general website that kind of points members to the different things that are available to them. But then there's this other program called Heart to Heart that was independent of the church. What's its relationship now, Keith, and where? I'll just let you jump in.
Yeah, glad to do so. It's Heart to Heart is also a 12-step program whose focus is among LDS addicts and overeaters and sex addicts and so forth. And they follow the 12 traditions. We haven't talked about that at all. There's 12 steps and 12 traditions. And one of the 12 traditions is non-affiliation. They do not affiliate with any organization or outside agency. They also, one of the other traditions of Alcoholics Anonymous is attraction and not promotion, in that they don't run ads, they don't get billboards. It's pretty much a word of mouth kind of a program. But you mentioned really well, Dan, the words of King Benjamin's address, and I would really highly recommend a book that's one of the foundational texts of Heart to Heart that's called He Did Deliver Me from Bondage. You'll find it in almost any LDS bookstore. The author is Colleen Harrison, and she is very, very gifted, because when I read that book, it's a workbook, she has done an amazing job of taking the literature and the wording of the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous and the words of the Book of Mormon, primarily, that's her primary source, and putting them together so that when you go to that workbook, you feel like you're reading the Book of Mormon with new eyes. There are so many recovery verses, if you want to call it that. I have many places in my scriptures where I've written step 7, step 3, step 9, because they're perfect. This is nothing new. It's just organized in a way that's just very accessible for very weak people like me. So He Did Deliver Me from Bondage is that book. And they still exist, and there are still meetings around. You just have to go on their website to find them.
And it's Heart, and it's like T apostrophe Heart.
Yeah,
right?
I think that there was a dating service that was Heart to Heart.
Okay.
Something like that. So
I'll make sure to do a link on that. And then One thing I think that we talked about before that might be good is right now the church's ARP program doesn't have online meetings, doesn't have really chats or whatever, and that is a function that Heart to Heart with the LDS community, you know, focus still, that's something that might work for some people where physical meetings don't.
That's my understanding. And anybody can start a meeting if you don't have the access to the LDS Family Services program in your area.
Very good. Good. Well, again, like I say, we just want to throw the options out there, and I'm sure there's plenty more. And we hope that those who come to the blog will just, again, always treat our podcast as we're just throwing some stuff out there. We're trying to start conversations, not feel like we've covered it all. So let us know where we've left off, and please engage Keith and John and Bill and each other with stories and whatever it is that you feel able to share. Let's have this just be the beginning. So anything more, Keith or John?
No, I feel like I've been a part of your community for a while. So Dan, it's kind of been an honor. And I, there's a saying at the end of the first 164 pages of the Big Book that says that someday we hope to meet you on the happy road of destiny. And so, someday we will not be anonymous to each other. We'll, hopefully we'll see some people that may have heard this, and maybe it, if not for them, at least a family member, it might have been a blessing.
That's awesome. Awesome. I love that. Thank you so much. And honored to talk with you guys. And just, this has really been, I guess we've been talking for a few weeks, and I've just been looking forward to this because there's something really powerful in the stuff that we discussed today. And I know it's some really beautiful blessings that are available out there for those that you know, can hear this as well as share this, as well as maybe those who really say, I am at that point where that step one is kicking me in the butt and letting me know that it's time that I admit defeat and figure out what I can do with God and not just trying to run it myself. So thank you very much, you guys. Listeners, thanks for all you do. Please keep donations going if you can. It's important. We love doing what we're doing, and if that's something you feel called to do. Happy to have you click the donate button every once in a while. So,
Dan, in your wrap up there, I just want you to know money never, ever changes hands in an ARP program, but you need to reread the seventh tradition. We are self-supporting through our own contributions. So if we like this, we need to make sure it sticks around. All right.
Cool. Thanks, man. Extra appeal there from the big book and the traditions. Awesome. Thank you. Hey, guys.
That's a wrap.
You guys, thanks again very much, and good night.
All right. Good night.
Thank you for joining us today on Mormon Matters Podcast. To discuss this podcast with others, please check us out at mormonmatters.org. To keep this podcast alive or to join our support community, please consider a tax-deductible donation today at mormonmatters.org. Music for this podcast was brought to you by Brittany and Clayton Pixton. The Mormon Matters logo was generously provided by StudioCase.com. Thank you for listening.